Michael, thank you.
The next case for argument is 143858, District of Nebraska, Melvin Morris III versus BNSF Railway Company.
All right, well, we'll hear from counsel. I'm not sure about your name, so I'll let you pronounce it.
No, Ari Rikus, Your Honor.
Very simple. Thank you. Right.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ari Rikus and Jennifer Turco Meyer on behalf of Melvin Morris, the appellant. This court should reverse the district court's order. The railroad medical staff made a medical determination that Mr. Morris was morbidly obese and disqualified him from employment. They relied on medical literature that directly correlates morbid obesity with the effects on the body systems. Despite their belief in the medical consequences of morbid obesity, and despite their reliance on the medical literature, they seek to absolve themselves of liability for what they did.
Now, I want to make sure I understand. As I understand your argument, which I think you're just beginning to articulate, it is contrary to Judge Gibbons' concurring opinion in Hawkins, where she spelled out the, as opposed to this never being an impairment, the essence of her position or her concurrence. Morbid obesity may have a physiological cause, but unless you prove a physiological cause, morbid obesity is not an impairment for ADA impairment. And as I understand your argument, it is that morbid obesity is a condition that is sufficiently physiological.
Correct, Your Honor. There are actually two ways.
My one follow-up, and then I'm probably done. What was the EEOC's regulatory response, if any, to the Sixth Circuit's decision in Hawkins, which it lost? It made your argument and lost. How has the EEOC responded to that?
Well, I believe that
rejection of its litigating position based on its own regulations.
I believe that the EEOC will maintain that Watkins.
The IRS, for example, acquiesces or doesn't acquiesce. Some agencies in some situations will react to a judicial defeat by amending the reg or the rule that was, in their view, interpreted not the way they liked. What did the EEOC do here?
I do not believe that the EEOC changed its interpretive guidance.
It didn't change the reg, did it?
Well, the reg merely says that.
I know what it says.
Well,
I mean, it says there's got to be a physical impairment has to have a physiological source, which is not, to this layman, is not all that crystal clear, but it's been construed by Hawkins and then what, four or five other circuits in a way that's inconsistent with your argument. And has the EEOC done anything about that?
I don't believe the EEOC has done anything about that, Your Honor.
We have regulatory acquiescence by silence.
I would say that the amendments, those cases, the circuit court cases came before the amendments to the ADA.
But they address a different subject. I've read the brief, and I'm satisfied that the amendments don't win this for you. They don't even touch on this issue, I don't think.
The amendments expand the definition of disability. Impairment is simply defined by the regulation as a physiological disorder or condition affecting the body systems. There is ample evidence that morbid obesity is in itself an impairment.
One of the problems I have with that, it may be an impairment, but here you've got the claimant who says, I'm not impaired. And so you have a conflict between the claimant says, I'm not impaired. The railroad says, he's not impaired now, but he could be impaired in the future. And that's where I am, and does the law cover that? And that's a bit of uncertainty because I don't understand that there's any physiological cause right now for the obesity, so I don't know where I am. Help me.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, there are two ways to prove disability. One is actual disability, in which you would have to prove that he is being a major life activity is being affected. And that is not what Mr. Morris is alleging on this appeal. He is going on the regarded as prong. All that is required under the regarded prong is to prove an actual impairment or a perceived impairment. Impairment is a physiological condition or disorder. So long as the employer perceives the person to have a physiological disorder, if they perceive morbid obesity as itself a physiological disorder.
That's right. It has to actually be an ADA impairment to trigger the regarded as liability. So the fact that the employer writes documents or something that would suggest that it considers morbid obesity to be a physiological disorder doesn't make it so, any more than the AMA can't make it so. This is a legal question, not a medical question.
Well, an impairment, obesity is a disease. All the literature talks about is being a disease of the human body affecting the body systems, which is the very reason in which the railroad company is denying Mr. Morris the position. They believe that obesity is going to cause a bunch of other conditions.
But that's true of a faulty heart valve, too, right? Or, you know, a lot of conditions.
Well, I don't know of a...
doesn't make them... I mean, it's a legal term. It's a word of art.
Well,
physical impairment.
Nowhere in the regulation does it say that one physiological impairment needs to cause another physiological impairment, Your Honor.
No, but that's begging the question. The first time you used the question is whether morbid obesity, regardless of cause, is a physiological disorder. And you've got a lot of medical folks, experts, who say from their standpoint the answer is yes. But we have six circuits applying the EEOC's regulatory language based on a statute who say no.
My time,
right?
Your Honor. My time is up. If I can answer your question, if I can, the regulatory, this is all based on an interpretive guidance trying to explain the regulations, and we cannot let the interpretive guidance that is supposed to get us out of the forest define what the law is.
It was based on the reg itself.
The reg merely defines impairment as a physiological disorder or condition affecting the body systems. It is the interpretive guidance that talks about characteristics and when some are caused by or not caused by a physiological disorder and so forth. It's our position that morbid obesity is a disease and not a physical characteristic in itself. I gave my time to the EEOC. Your Honors, thank you.
Ms. King, you may proceed.
Thank you. Anne King on behalf of Amicus Curiae Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I'd like to address some of the questions that came up earlier. In our view, the most simple way to avoid dissonance with other decisions, including the Watkins decision, is to focus on the perceived impairment approach to establishing regarded as liability. Under the amended ADA, Congress revised that section of the statute to encompass perceived impairments, not just regarded as claims based on actual impairments. So, in fact, it's not necessary...
Just to make sure you know where I am, I'm taking your silence. I'm taking your argument going off in a different direction as implicitly conceding my regulatory acquiescence by silence point.
Okay. Well, I'll address that first then, because I think that's a really important point.
Well, why didn't you start there?
My apologies, Your Honor. So let's focus on that. It's true that the concurrence in Watkins took issue with the EEOC's interpretation of its own interpretive guidance, but I don't read the majority to do that. And I should also mention that
Gibbons was more compromising in tone, if you will.
Well, the majority in Watkins really focused on a past Sixth Circuit decision, the Andrews decision, and that, as I read the majority, was the main basis for their decision. Excuse me, sorry to interrupt there. And I also just to highlight that...
What's the agency's response to the line that Judge Gibbons said was appropriate that multiple circuits have followed?
Well, a couple of responses to
Other than to repeat its losing litigating position in this amicus appearance.
A couple of responses. The first is that we actually have successfully advanced that position after the Watkins decision in the Resources for Human Development case. Which was it's a district court case that the accepted our that was so that was in the I believe the Eastern District of Louisiana. But I just mentioned that to point out that we have maintained the same position that we took in Watkins, and to respond to your point about other circuits, BNSF overstates the degree to which the circuits support its position. Watkins, it identifies as the leading case, but Francis, the Second Circuit decision that it cites, doesn't actually involve morbid obesity. And in fact, the Francis decision, as we explain in our brief, suggested that morbid obesity might be a different situation, that it would be possible to establish an impairment. Some other circuits have looked at this question but haven't said definitively that a physiological basis is required in a case of morbid obesity. The Third Circuit in Lesko and the 11th Circuit in, I believe, Goldberg, both of which we cite in our briefs, mentioned that courts have applied that requirement but did not actually reach that issue or apply that requirement. So really, Watkins is the only circuit court decision on that cleanly supports BNSF's position when it comes to morbid obesity. And I would just like to respond again to that.
Watkins before the amendment?
Watkins is before the amendments. And
well, if we follow Watkins, the amendment didn't make any changes.
It did, because the amendments recognized that perceived impairment may be a ground on which to base a regarded as claim.
Watkins was an actual impairment?
It was a regarded as claim, but it was before the amendments clarified that a regarded as claim can be based on a perceived impairment, so there's no need to actually show an impairment, just that the employer believed, as was the case here, a jury could find, that the employee had a condition that affected a body system.
Perceived is different from a regarded as, then, of course.
Right. Well, perceived impairment is part of the regarded as prong. Under the amendments, regarded as liability can be predicated on discrimination based on actual impairment or based on a perceived impairment. And so I do think the most...
What's the statutory section for that?
That is 42 U.S.C. 12-102-3A. And in enacting that, Congress specifically... overruled the Sutton decision, which had a more narrow understanding of regarded as liability. So the fact that Watkins is pre-ADA amendments matters to the largest degree because it's before this change to the regarded as prong.
When you've got a perceived disability, which means you don't get hired, it's not a matter of accommodation. You have both the employee saying, I can do the work, and the doctor, the company, saying, yes, he can do the work. there could not be an actual actual disability of some accommodation at all. And the problem I have is going to the perceived disability, you don't have it perceived by the employee, and you don't, by the employer says he can do the work, but there's risk in the future. And I don't understand that as physiological. It's predictive more than that.
I want to just respond to one thing you mentioned at the beginning. You, Judge Bright, used the term perceived disability. And in many of the pre-amendments cases, you'll see regarded as claims referred to as perceived disability claims. But the post-amendments language is different because it differentiates between actual impairments and perceived impairments. So perceived impairment's a little bit different than a perceived disability. But to address your larger question, the record here, a jury could find, supports the conclusion that BNSF actually perceived Morris as having an impairment that affected him at that moment, because a jury could conclude that the company believed that he was so subject to sudden incapacitation that it could happen at any time. And it's especially notable the contrast between how it treated Morris and how it treated individuals who had actual conditions that it also correlated with sudden incapacitation. It would allow those individuals to work in safety-sensitive positions with a case-by-case determination, but not Morris. So I think that's enough for a jury to determine that BNSF did view it as a current perceived impairment.
So the agency's view is that since he was physically qualified and needed no accommodation, he had to be hired.
Well, our view is that the employer always has recourse to defenses, which I know BNSF covers in its brief. And so if there are safety concerns that come into play, the defenses are the right place to look at those concerns, to appropriate place to analyze those concerns, rather than at the prima facie case of whether someone is covered under the statute. Pardon me?
BNSF would have to wait for the litigation stage to raise those, basically, as defenses.
Well, it could certainly contemplate them earlier on, but again, it would have to wait for the litigation stage to raise that he's not qualified under the statute as well.
And as far as the amicus brief, your response would be that to their allegation that the EEOC is just through these interpretive guidelines and everything is trying to inject its own policy and political philosophy, as it were.
Well, for the guidance,
it may or may not bear any relationship to the real world in which employers hire employees.
Well, for the guidance, that goes through a long process. And in terms of our interpretation of the guidance in this brief and in past cases, we've actually held that, contrary to BNSF's assertion, we've held that the position we advance here for quite some time. I think we first advanced it in an amicus brief in the Cook versus Rhode Island decision, which we cite. So that's back in the 90s, and we continue to put it forth.
So I don't think the amicus brief makes it in this bold statement, but I almost gathered from it that once the amendments came out, the EEOC felt that it had free rein to go wherever it wanted.
Well, our take is that the amendments only make more clear that our longstanding interpretation is the most natural interpretation.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Neal, good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. The positions that are being taken here on the other side, asking you to reverse Judge Cuff's decision, are in fact inconsistent with a long line of cases, as well as the EEOC's guidance. Now, I just heard EEOC talking about its position in amicus briefs filed in various courts. I think employers are entitled to look at the regulation and look at the guidance that is gone through that process that counsel just spoke of and rely on that. And that's exactly what BNSF and other many other employers do. You know, we shouldn't have changes made through different positions being taken in amicus briefs filed in court. Now, I want to jump to something that I heard on the other side concerning perceived impairment, and I think it may have left an impression that the concept of a perceived impairment is something that is new after the 2008 ADA Amendments Act. That is not the case at all. The statute since 1990 has always had, among the three different types of disabilities, a regarded as disability. That regarded as disability has always included the option of either an actual or a perceived impairment. The change was that it used to require an actual impairment, and we're all talking about perception, so it's all a regarded as impairment, which could be either someone viewing, an employer viewing an applicant or employee as having an actual impairment or perceiving them as having an impairment that they don't really have. The employer also, in the old days, had to perceive that impairment, actual or perceived, as substantially limiting their ability to work. That's what went away in the amendments, but the concept of an actual impairment or a perceived impairment has always been there. And that's
specifically
the substantial limitation portion of the regarded as test. You know, that is what Congress wanted to change, and they lessened the standard for the other two types of disability. For regarded as disabilities, they eliminated it entirely. But this case is not about the substantial limitation issue at all. It's about the actual or perceived impairment, which, as I say, has always been part of the statute. In fact, this court's decision in the Fisher case that I submitted a couple of days ago in a Rule 28J letter, which I hope you all received, talks about the perceived impairment issue under the post-amendment law. And the court there, I won't go so far as to claim that you actually resolved this case in that decision, but you did make some rulings that go a long way toward resolving this case. And one of them is to talk about how a perceived impairment claim is evaluated. And the court made clear that the employer has to be looking at the employee and considering that that employee has a condition that meets the definition of an impairment under the applicable regulation. And the Fisher case is always also interesting because it involves strength, which is not too far away from the issue we're talking about in terms of weight as a characteristic. And I say not too far away because when you look at the EEOC's guidance that was referenced earlier, it talks about height, weight, and muscle tone. And in some other publications, their compliance manual, EEOC seems to suggest that what they mean by muscle tone is strength, because they say height, weight, and strength. And those are things that are not impairments. This court looked at strength in Fisher and said that the employer perceiving someone as not having the strength that the employer wanted and as having a strength that they thought put that person at risk of injury in the future did not equate to perceiving that it was actually an applicant trying to come back to work, so I'll say applicant, as having an impairment under the post-amendment statute.
Is that Fisher?
Yes, sir.
I've cited it in your letter.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, there was also a suggestion that Watkins is the only case, that only circuit court case that supports us, and I, of course, disagree with that. I think that Andrews and Francis also support us. And what we're talking about here is what is the legal standard for an impairment with respect to weight. You know, and that's what those cases talk about. There's nothing in those cases that would suggest that morbid obesity, as it's being defined here, would have satisfied the situation, satisfied the claim requirements in those cases. And I say as it's being defined here because you'll see in the briefs there are a wide variation of definitions of somewhat of obesity, but mostly of morbid obesity. The standard that EEOC adopted in its compliance manual was 100% over norm weight. In its brief now, and in the apparently in the amicus brief it submitted in that Cook case that it referred to, it used a different standard, 100 pounds over optimal weight, or 100% over optimal, or double optimal weight. And that's part of our problem with trying to pick a standard and saying if it's morbid obesity, it therefore is an impairment, because then you have to decide what exactly does that mean. It's pretty clear that today class 3 obesity, which is also sometimes referred to as morbid obesity, is a substantially lower threshold than 100% over norm weight, which is...
And I'll ask you a question after
I was just answering. I was just going to say which is what was talked about in the compliance manual. So happy to answer your question, Judge.
If your client considered obesity to pose an unacceptably high risk for the development of a future impairment, don't we conclude from that you regarded obesity itself to be an impairment?
No. You know, this is a question of coverage, and where does the statute draw the line? The statute draws the line at a perception that an employee or an applicant has an impairment.
What did your client perceive? What did the railroad perceive about this man?
They perceived that he was an applicant for an employment with a BMI of over 40, a body mass index of over 40.
Which, in the railroad's eyes, constituted what? An unacceptably high risk of future problems?
A potential future problem that could lead to an incapacitating injury or incapacitating condition while he's out working on the railroad around heavy moving equipment.
And under the guidelines, that's not a permissible view that the employer may take. It may take a view, but it's not a permissible reason to not hire this person.
Well, we're talking about whether the person is covered by the statute. So if the person's not covered...
Okay, covered by the statute. If it's covered by the statute, then...
If the person has an impairment, if we get an applicant who has diabetes...
Yes, we know. But getting back to the facts of the case, this man, if he were employed, be working out near Alliance shop.
Yes.
We had a case from there several years ago with these 400,000-pound railroad engines that he's going to be working on.
Yes.
And is it the railroad's position that he might slip and fall, or that he would pass out while at work and endanger the lives of his coworkers? Or?
All of those things are possibilities because of the high correlation of incapacitating injuries to high BMI.
And, of course, that, I guess, would go to Ms. Jackson's... that could be your defense in a lawsuit, I guess, that he doesn't meet your qualifications for as a safe employee. Well, that's crudely stated, perhaps inaccurately stated also. But anyway, go on.
Well, that certainly would be part of the defense, and we've asserted that secondarily. But our position is that treating someone as though they may develop or even are likely to develop an impairment in the future is not the same thing as treating them as having an impairment now.
And again, your strongest case for that is?
Strongest case for that is actually, well, Fisher is probably the most recent strongest one, because this court said even though they thought this person had a strength deficit, so a physical condition that caused a deficit that the employer thought posed an unacceptable risk, that did not equate to regarding the person as having an impairment. But the other thing that supports it is the language in the EEOC guidance itself. Characteristic predisposition to illness or disease is not an impairment. So viewing someone not as if they have an impairment today, but as if they're likely to develop one in the future is permissible. That is where Congress drew the line. We have to have a perception that today they have an impairment, not a perception that they will have one in the future. And speaking of Congress, let me move on to a slightly different point about the overall claim here. You know, what from our position, what you're being asked to do is essentially recognize a new protected characteristic, protected category under the statute. Whether something like obesity or excess weight should be protected by federal law from discrimination is something that ought to be decided through appropriate debate and consideration in Congress, not through finagling an interpretation of this regulatory language that is about an impairment, a physiological disorder, not about a person's size.
Okay, tell them I'll get the rest on the Judge Bright will have to leave us now, but we'll continue, and he will listen to the tape for the rest of it.
Thank you, Judge Bright.
So we'll just pause just for a second.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. You may proceed. Continue, sir.
Thank you. The ramifications of accepting excess weight as a protected characteristic are significant ramifications to employers. It's a new category that employers would have responsibilities for and have to avoid claims of discrimination on. But the point I want to leave you with is to remind the court that the definition of disability in the ADA does not only apply to Title I, which is the employment provision. There are several other titles of the statute, one of which applies to all governmental bodies in their dealings with the public. The other one, Title III, applies to private entities that make available goods and services to the public. So if we're going to treat obesity as a new protected category, it's going to have ramifications that are far-reaching beyond employment. We're going to be looking at, you know, airlines. Are they going to have to give two seats as an accommodation? And you're not allowed to charge for an accommodation, so it would be two seats for free. We have theaters and sports arenas that today have wheelchair seating. Are we going to now require double seats or big and tall seats or plus size seats? We have retail stores that sell clothing. Are they going to have to sell a certain size clothing or stock the same amount of that clothing or make it just as accessible as the other clothing that they're selling? All those sorts of things are issues that would be raised by treating excess weight or obesity as a protected characteristic under the ADA far beyond the employment situation.
And to make sure that I got this down, a moment before Judge Bright left, you said the EEOC is asking us to recognize a new what? A new category of impairment or a new what?
Well, essentially a new protected characteristic.
That was your word of art that I wasn't able to write fast. Protected characteristics. Thank you.
Right. Now, they'll tell you that they're not asking to
a new one. But lawyers being lawyers.
All right, Judge. If there are no other questions, I'll give up the rest of my time.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And do they have time for rebuttal?
No, all the time has been used for the appellant.
I'll give you the option. Is it okay if we give them a couple? I'll give you a couple of minutes, whether you want it or... Oh, that's right. You have time. I'm sorry. I'd forgotten your listing here. You were going to do the rebuttal, so I guess I won't give you the option of choosing which lawyer. Yeah. Ms. Chukoro Meyer, I get it right?
Chukoro Meyer, Your Honor.
Oh, well, I'm sorry for being confused, as
it's okay.
Not infrequently the case.
Oh, no problem, Your Honor. What I'd like to do, Your Honor, may it please the court, Jennifer Meyer for the appellant, is address a few of the questions that were brought up by Judge Logan and Judge Bright. The first question I want to talk about is Watkins and why there's no issue with the EEOC not changing anything after the decision in Watkins, especially with Judge Gibbons. Judge Gibbons actually cites the First Circuit opinion of Cook versus Rhode Island and says that decision is a good decision. And that decision actually supports the idea that you don't have to have a physiological cause for obesity to be a physical impairment. And also it supports the notion that that a company, when they perceive somebody to be at risk for future impairments, they are actually violating the regarded as prong. Additionally, along the lines of what Judge Bright was asking in terms of questions, is the ADAAA actually did change the statute of the way regarded as is treated. And it took out the substantially limiting analysis, which is important because our client, Melvin Morris, saying he wasn't substantially limited in his daily life activities has no relevance on a regarded as claim anymore. All that's relevant is whether he had a physiological disorder, which the Burlington Northern diagnosed Melvin Morris with when they took his measurements, his height and his weight. They used their medical literature.
You're begging the question of whether this particular condition is a physiological disorder.
We're not.
And I hear you, since you begged the question, I hear you saying the amendments really didn't change the question that I'm calling begged.
I'm not sure that I understand how
the distinction that Judge Gibbons made between morbid obesity being a physiological disorder and morbid obesity only being covered if it is caused by a medically determined physiological disorder, which I gather the record is clear, Mr. Morris does not have.
Does not.
No treating physician could figure out why he couldn't deal with his morbid obesity.
Your Honor, I agree that the treating physician does not attribute a physiological cause to Mr. Morris's morbid obesity.
The issue in the case is whether that there has to be one.
Exactly. And our argument is that Burlington Northern, when they told him he had class 3 obesity, they were diagnosing him with a physiological condition of morbid obesity.
Okay, but that begs the question. You can't have regarded as, unless there's an impairment as a covered impairment. The perception has to be of a covered impairment, not of some condition like you're not blonde and blue-eyed or whatever.
You're right, Your Honor. There's two prongs to the regarded as claim. The first could be that you prove there's an actual impairment, which we argue was proven. But the second prong is the perceived impairment, which doesn't have anything to do with whether or not Mr. Morris was morbidly obese. It's what the Burlington Northern thought about Melvin Morris and his morbid obesity. And there's a lot of literature, or there's a lot of comment by, there's a lot of comment about how if you have an impairment, the risk of future diseases is something that you can discriminate against somebody for.
Well, what circuit case law supports that?
Well, the Cook case does, specifically under perceived impairment.
That's pre-amendment, of course.
Well, it is. But it's also
what post-amendment circuit court suggests the amendments make a difference to this issue.
Your Honor, our opinion is that your court will be the court of first impression on the issue.
Well, that's good to know.
Okay. There's no other questions. I'm out of time.
I asked Mr. Neal to make sure that I have to repeat his position so I could write it down in my slow handwriting. You said the amendment actually changed what?
The amendments actually changed the statute with regard to regarded as claims. And they took out what was such an issue with Sutton, which was the substantially limiting analysis.
Okay, sure. Took out the Sutton thing. I think. Well, the case is submitted. We thank all sides for the argument. And so I guess we'll be the First Circuit. And the case will give it our best efforts.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Madam Clerk.